Welcome. You're listening to Latin Waves with your hosts, Sylvia and Stuart Richardson. Latin Waves is a syndicated show produced in the studios of CJSF Radio in Burnaby, BC. Latin Waves is more than just hot rhythms. This is a show about community, about creating a culture that is inclusive and based on fairness. Because everyone deserves dignity, respect, and has something to contribute. A new world is possible, and it all starts with us.
Basically, what the capitalists want to do right now, when there's a big economic crisis, what they want to do is they want to make the workers pay for this crisis. Crisis that workers had no part in creating was created by the system itself, and particularly by financial speculators, bankers, and so on.
That's the voice of Jorge Martin from Hands Off Venezuela. On this week's edition of Latin Waves, we speak to Jorge about the ongoing struggles and uprisings in the Middle East and how that affects the struggle back home in places like Wisconsin. So stay tuned.
Privileged this morning to have Jorge Martin. He is the Secretariat of Hands Off Venezuela. Welcome to our show.
It's a pleasure to be with you again.
We all celebrated the uprisings of people in Africa, Yemen, Tunisia. We are now hearing of the struggle for people in Libya. As the news of the uprising in Libya came out, an email was sent saying that President Chavez was going to give asylum to Gaddafi. How would you explain these rumors, and what would you consider the intent behind them?
Well, first of all, I have to say that this was a complete lie. It was completely false. This rumor originated with the British Conservative Party government of David Cameron and his Foreign Affairs Minister William Hague. And it's quite clear that the intention was to say, well, Chavez is a dictator, therefore he's giving asylum to Gaddafi, who is also another dictator. It was trying to imply that the two of them are basically the same thing, when this is clearly not the case. In any case, I mean, this was a lie. On Wednesday, there was a Prime Minister's questions time in British Parliament, and William Hague was specifically asked about this, and he admitted that this was not true. But he said that he had heard these rumors, and he just repeated them. But in any case, it's completely irresponsible for a politician to repeat something that he's only heard, of which he has no confirmation at all. And it's clear that he did it in order to try to paint with the same brush Chavez and Gaddafi. And it's part of a general campaign of misinformation and lies about the government of Hugo Chavez. The government of Hugo Chavez has been elected democratically on at least 12 occasions, if you include the different referendums, the different local, regional, national elections, constituent assembly elections, parliamentary elections, presidential elections, since 1998. And the Venezuelan people have given support to the Bolivarian project on numerous occasions throughout these years, from 1998 until 2011. The Venezuelan revolution is completely democratic, and it's the will of the people. And it's the same people, like William Hague and others, who supported the coup in April 2002 against the democratically elected government of Venezuela, who are now spreading this kind of rumors, obviously.
To clear the record, what is the position of the Hands Off Venezuela and the people in Venezuela to the uprising in the Middle East, in Africa, in Tunisia, Libya, and in Egypt?
I mean, obviously, in Venezuela, people have different opinions. But the government has said quite clearly, and Chavez has said clearly, that he does support the uprising of the Arab people, the Arab revolution that has started. And the main reason for this, I would say, for the Venezuelan people is that they also had similar uprising in February 1989, when there was the Caracas uprising. People came out on the streets against increased prices of basic foodstuffs, increased price of public transportation, and so on. And there was a massacre. The army was used by the government of the time, of Carlos Andrés Pérez, against the unarmed demonstrators, and it's calculated that anything between 2,000 and 3,000 people were killed. So they can clearly identify with the situation where people come out on the streets demanding justice, demanding jobs, demanding lower food prices, and demanding freedom. And they are massacred by the army, as was the case in Egypt, as was the case in Tunisia, and it is also now the case in Libya. So, I mean, this is our position that we have taken in solidarity with the Arab revolution.
While the media was quick to pose the comments by William Hague, they seemed to be reluctant or unable to cover the uprising in Wisconsin. Can you talk about this?
Not only they don't cover the uprising in Wisconsin, but they take a completely different position to the uprising in Bahrain, for instance. Bahrain is a country which is the site of the 4th Fleet of the United States, a close ally of the United States. They are also massacring the civilian population, and not a word is heard from the big imperialist powers. There's no discussion of a no-fly zone, no kicking Bahrain out of the United Nations Human Rights Commission or anything like this. And as for Wisconsin, here we have another case of people coming out on the streets defending basic human rights, in this case trade union rights, basic trade union rights, the right of workers to be represented by the trade unions in negotiating with their employers. And this is not covered in any of the major networks. And obviously this is something that can count on the solidarity of people in Venezuela. And in fact, I will say that Wisconsin, the movement in Wisconsin was to a certain extent also inspired by the movement of the masses in Tunisia and Egypt. And the people in Madison were calling the governor Hosni Walker, and they were calling for people to demonstrate like they do in Egypt. And there were lots of shows of solidarity between Egyptian workers and workers in Madison. Obviously, there's not much coverage of that in the mainstream media.
It's important to realize that while the struggle in Wisconsin has been over the right to contract bargaining to retain the very few rights we still have within the union movement, and the bill, which is called the Right to Work, which obviously is a lie because it is the right to work for slave wages. It is the right to work without being able to negotiate safety or salary increase to have any power within the bargain. How does this contrast to the way the government of Venezuela negotiates with the union movement within that country?
I would say it's precisely the opposite. Since the Bolivarian Revolution started and Chavez came to power in 1998, there's been an absolute explosion of trade union rights in Venezuela. Hundreds of workplaces have been organized, and people have been encouraged by the government to do so. Not only this, but there's been a whole number of factory closures in Venezuela by the employers, either because of the economic crisis or just plain sabotage of the revolution. And Chavez has encouraged workers to occupy the workplaces, and in some cases these have been nationalized in order to save and defend jobs, which is precisely the opposite of what's happening in the United States. And there's now discussions of a new labor law which is going to be passed by the National Assembly. Workers have been encouraged to set up factory councils. And there's one interesting case, which is the Sidor Steelworks in Bolivar, where there's about 16,000 workers. And this had been privatized under the previous government. And the workers had lost most of their collective bargaining rights. And as a result of the struggle of the workers, the Chavez government decided to renationalize the Argentinian-owned steel mills and to bring all the workers that had been subcontracted to the main contract, so they all covered by collective bargaining agreements. Say there's a big contrast, and this is one of the reasons why Telesur, the Venezuelan funded TV network, has been sent a correspondent to Madison, has been covering the protests on a daily basis.
I wanted to comment on that because as the Bolivarian Revolution has taken hold, one of the priorities for the government has been education, which is precisely what is being under attack in the United States, particularly in Madison, Wisconsin, with the teachers being the ones persecuted by the government. Why is there a connection between education and the agenda of neoliberalism?
I think the connection is clear. Basically, what the capitalists want to do right now when there's a big economic crisis, what they want to do is they want to make the workers pay for this crisis. Crisis that workers had no part in creating was created by the system itself, and particularly by financial speculators, bankers, and so on. And they want to make the workers pay by destroying everything that's been won by the labor movement over the last 100 years. And amongst these things is also education, the right to health care, the right to go to university and things like this. And we see this across the board and in every single country in the world. You've seen this in Europe, in many countries. But in Venezuela, what we see is precisely the opposite. As there is a movement that is moving away from capitalism in the direction of socialism, there's higher investment in education, there's higher investment in health care, and there's more workers, there's more protection for workers' rights, and so on. It's two different ways of approaching this question of the economic crisis and the budget deficit and so on. In the case of Madison, the excuse for this bill is that we need to cut the budget deficit. But as a matter of fact, the trade unions did offer to make all sorts of concessions in relation to pay, conditions, wages and benefits and so on, as long as the right to collective bargaining was kept. And still the governor went ahead with the law. And in the way it was passed in the end, it didn't have any financial aspects to it. It was just pure and naked anti-trade union law. And the importance of this is because once you destroy the rights for workers to be represented by the trade unions to act collectively in the defense of their interests, then you can destroy all the other bits and pieces that they've won over many, many years.
Senator Scott Walker was barely 6 weeks since his election when he started giving tax cuts to the top 1% within his states, which created the deficit that now he claims has left him with his hands tied and he can no longer bargain with the unions. When we look at this example, it's upsetting because it's not unique. In Canada, we're seeing a similar trend. When the government here in British Columbia got elected in 2000, the first thing they did was to give tax cuts to the 1% that's the wealthiest. How would you describe the catalyst, the mobilize the people in Venezuela?
The early indications that there was a big movement brewing in Venezuela was in 89. That's a long time away, when these neoliberal policies of capitalism unleashed were at its peak, the times of, just after Ronald Reagan and Margaret Thatcher and so on. And there was this big uprising. This uprising was completely spontaneous, had no clear leadership, no clear aims. But it was very clear on what it was against. It was against the increased food prices, increased fuel prices, and so on. And it was at that point that people realized that the system wasn't working. It wasn't working from a political point of view because the poor were not properly represented and the rich controlled the government, which is pretty much what's happening in the United States right now. And secondly, it wasn't working from an economic point of view because it could no longer guarantee things that were taken for granted in the past. And I will say that these two conditions are the same that exist now in the advanced capitalist countries of, say, the United States or most European countries. We are seeing similar results. I'm not saying that there's a revolutionary situation in Madison, Wisconsin yet, but the people are coming out on the streets. They're taking direct action to solve their problems. They're taking collective action. They're realizing that they are powerful if they are united and they're mobilized. And the same thing is happening throughout Europe. You know, I mean, even in Britain, where not much was happening for many years, there's been big demonstrations of the students. There's a demonstration coming up on the 26th of March, which is calculated that maybe 500,000 people will come out on the streets to protest against cuts and austerity budgets and so on. There's been a big movement in France in the autumn. There have been already, say, I think it's 8 or 9 general strikes in Greece since the austerity packages were introduced a year ago. And so I think that similar conditions are starting to create similar results. The people also in the advanced capitalist countries find that there's no other way to defend their rights, what they've acquired over many years of struggle, but to come out on the streets and in a collective way and fight for what is theirs. Otherwise, the situation will only get worse. And so I will say that the Arab Revolution, the Latin American Revolution, are not isolated phenomena. They are part of a worldwide trend whereby people are starting to come out on the streets and mobilize, and that is very positive.
Right now, we are watching as we see that the United Nations has approved a no-fly zone for Libya. What is the significance of this decision?
Well, I will say that, first of all, the United Nations, particularly the countries that voted for this resolution, the United States, France, Britain, and other countries that voted in favor, they've never cared about human rights. They never cared about loss of human life anywhere, really. I mean, they're not voting a no-fly zone over the Gaza Strip. They're not voting a no-fly zone over Bahrain or over Yemen, where unarmed demonstrators are being killed by their regimes. All they're interested is in getting the interests protected. And in this case, Libya is an oil-producing country, and they would like to have the oil contracts protected for the future. But also they're establishing a precedent whereby the big imperialist powers can intervene in these countries where there's a revolutionary movement taking place in order to try to divert it, diffuse it, contain it, and make it so it's not dangerous for the interest. So I'd say it's sheer hypocrisy that they're now talking about this no-fly zone, when only months ago, at the beginning of February or earlier, they were just friends with Gaddafi. They were making business with him. They were arming him. They were training his military. And the weapons he's using now against the civilian population, he got from the West. He got in contracts with Britain, with the United States, with France, and so on. So it's just sheer hypocrisy. Plus, it will not resolve any of the issues on the ground. I will say that imperialism is trying to intervene in the Arab world, trying to contain the revolution by different means in different countries.
What are the threats faced by Venezuela in view of this power that we see of countries like the U.S., France, and Canada, in Haiti, and Honduras?
Why is it that they tried to paint Gaddafi and Chavez with the same brush? Because they now are going to use this UN resolution against Gaddafi, with whom they made businesses until yesterday, as I said. But nevertheless, they would like to be able to do a similar thing in Venezuela, which is also an oil-producing country they want to control. But above all, because there is a revolution which is a very powerful example, inspiration for other countries around the world. And this is a very real threat for Venezuela. The United States Department and Pentagon or different agencies in the United States government have been funding, training, supporting, advising the counter-revolutionary opposition in Venezuela, which has tried on many occasions to overthrow the democratically elected government. Now, I do not think that the threat of military intervention is immediate in Venezuela, because precisely imperialism is scattered all over the world. They're trying to put down fires here and there, Afghanistan, Iraq, revolution in the Arab world, Libya. They've got lots of problems to deal with. They are in a weak position to intervene against Venezuela, which is a revolution that has overwhelming support. I would say that the threat to the Venezuelan revolution comes mainly from within. The growing feeling there is within the movement in Venezuela, the revolution is not advancing fast enough, that there is an internal bureaucracy within the movement that's preventing the revolution from going forward. And this is a very real danger. You see, in the elections on September 26 last year, victory for the Bolivarian forces was very narrow. Only 100,000 votes separated the Bolivarians from the opposition, the counter-revolutionary opposition. And the reason for this was not that the opposition increased its number of votes, but the Bolivarians lost 1 million votes. That is 1 million people who voted for Chavez before. This time they weren't prepared to vote for Chavez and they abstained because they're becoming disillusioned, skeptical, demoralized by the slow pace of the revolution. I would say that this is the main danger. The revolution, the counter-revolution is just biding its time. They're just waiting for the next presidential elections next year and see whether this process of demoralization goes further and they are able to win that election, which will be a serious blow. So I would say that's the main threat to the revolution. Imperialism is still plotting, but I'd say that they are in a bit of a weak position to attack Venezuela right now with everything that's going on at the same time.
Thank you so much for being with us. I want to conclude by talking a little bit about the worker movement worldwide, because as I mentioned earlier, some of the problems being faced by Wisconsin teachers are being faced by people here in Canada, with ongoing attacks on the teaching profession being standardized, introducing standardized tests for students, and totally de-skilling the teaching profession. But also, there's an increasing talk of privatizing services as a way to cut costs. Can you talk about some of the challenges you face in the UK, and how are people in the UK dealing with these issues?
Well, here we had the Labour Party government, which wasn't conducting pro-Labour policies. The Labour Party has been hijacked by a small clique around Tony Blair, and they carried out right-wing policies. They already went ahead with privatization and outsourcing and so on, attacks on public services. They brought us into the war in Iraq, in Afghanistan, and so on. But now the new government has been elected, the conservative liberal democratic government was elected last year, and they've unleashed a real one-sided war against the working class, against public services, and so on. One of the first measures that they introduced was the massive increase in tuition fees, which went up from a maximum of £3,000 a year, which is already a lot of money. I think that must be about, I don't know, $4,500, $5,000 to $9,000. So that's a trebling of the maximum amount for tuition fees at university. That created a big movement of the students in November and December. The movement was not successful finally, but I think it had a big impact in changing the consciousness of many people that these cuts are real, these cuts are coming. This cut will affect everybody. Now they're talking about slashing the pension system. They are attacking the health service. But education is one of the main targets, you know. And so people are starting to move. And as I said, on the 26th of March, just a week from now, there will be a mass demonstration in London, and the trade unions are calling for it. And they're already expecting something like 500,000 people to turn up. This will be a big move. This is the beginning again of a massive movement against the right wing. And I have to say that teachers are leading the way. UCU, which is the lecturers and college and university lecturers union, is calling for strikes in 65 different universities and colleges throughout the country, starting next week. Local authority teachers, secondary and primary education teachers, are also mobilizing in the different municipalities and local councils where cuts are being implemented. So I think that we're starting to see the class struggle also coming to Britain after a long period where there wasn't much going on. And I will say again that people here have been inspired by what's been going on in the Arab world. Obviously, the situation is different. Conditions are different. But there's one basic common thread, you know, and the basic common thread is that if people want something, they have to fight for it. They have to come out in their millions to achieve it. But also, it can be done. It's not hopeless. Not all struggles lead to defeat. It is possible to win. So if it's possible to overthrow a tyrant dictator like Ben Ali or Mubarak, then it's surely possible to reverse policies here in Britain or somewhere else. But at the same time, we're up against a very powerful enemy. That is the crisis of capitalism, which is also very serious, very deep. And so we need to struggle, yes, but I would say we also need to think. We also need to develop an alternative theory, an alternative to the crisis of capitalism, which, in my opinion, has to be a socialist society where resources are run democratically, by working people themselves in the benefit of everyone, not in the benefit of a small wealthy minority, of which we were talking before.
As we hear the call for general strikes, I was speaking with economist Robin Handel, and he said, you know, it seems like such a simple thing, but when you think about it, he says, that is the backbone of a cap enterprise, right? If the workers refuse to work, the whole thing comes down. And so when we're told, you know, that strikes are ineffective, that a general strike is just a waste of time and an inconvenience, what do you say to people?
I'd say it's precisely the opposite, you know. I think it was Trotsky who said this, the Russian revolutionary, Leon Trotsky, he said that without the kind permission of the working class, not a wheel turns, not light bulb shines. It is working people who make society run, but only most normal times they do not realize the power they have. And it is only times like this, with massive strikes or even a general strike, when they realize that without working people, nothing works, and they have this massive power, which they have to use in order to defend their interests. There's been many general strikes throughout history. Not all of them have been successful. General strike is part of the process of transforming society.
And we may not always win, but we certainly don't always lose. Why is it important for us to not only protect, but also confront when misinformation about Venezuela is portrayed on the media?
It's precisely because Venezuela is one place where we are winning, and that's why the media is so interested in spreading lies and misinformation about what's happening there, because they don't want people in other parts of the world to get the idea that they can do the same. In Venezuela, there's massive investment in education. There's been the expansion of university education, eradication of illiteracy. There's been massive investment in healthcare. There's been renationalization of privatized companies, workers taking over the factories, introducing workers' control. This is a very dangerous example. It's a very dangerous idea. And that's why they want to prevent people from knowing, people from finding out the truth. And they want to paint Chavez as a dictator or as a madman or as an extremist or anything like this, you know. And this is why it is important, as part of our own struggle in our own countries, to combat this misinformation so that people can get the idea that, there is one place where we are winning. We should take that as an inspiration, as an example of what we should be doing.
Thank you so much for being with us. For people who want to participate, how do they get involved?
Well, basically, you can contact us through our website, which is handsofvenezuela.org, and find the information there. There's Hands of Venezuela groups going on across Canada, in the United States, in Europe, about, I think it's 40 to 50 countries throughout the world. These are exciting times. And the struggle is going beyond Latin America. It's now reaching the Middle East, the Arab world. But also reaching the advanced capitalist countries of Europe. And even in Madison, Wisconsin, they're talking about a general strike. That's completely unprecedented. And if I told anybody just a year ago that in an important city in the United States they will be discussing the possibility of a general strike, people will have said that maybe I was exaggerating or was wishful thinking, you know. And now it is happening. We need to get involved. We need to get informed. We need to discuss politics and ideas. And we need to get involved in the struggle in a practical way at the same time.
Thank you again for being with us.
Thank you for having me.
Take care.
We have come to the end of our show, Latin Waves. Latin Waves is a weekly syndicated program produced and broadcast from the studios of CGSF Radio in Burnaby, BC. The program is available free of charge to campus and community stations across Canada and the U.S. For more information about our work or to support our efforts, please visit our website at www.latinwavesmedia.com. Bye for now.